Live from the Dolby Theater in Los Angeles, it's the 87th Annual Academy Awards. And here's your host, Kyone Wolf. Thank you, thank you. The orchestra pit sounds great. For now, just don't make me send J.K. Simmons into the pit. Tonight we will honor the most outstanding work done in the past year by white actors. Too soon? Of course, this year, everybody's talking about Boyhood, a feature film made over the course of 12 years, almost double the length of a typical Oscar Awards show. And how about Birdman? In the course of 2 hours, Michael Keaton has hallucinatory conversations with a costumed flying man, runs naked through Times Square, and shoots off his own nose in front of a packed house. Or as Matthew McConaughey calls it, Thursday. This year, we saw Matthew in Interstellar, which probed one of the deepest questions in physics. What if one of his Lincoln commercials was somehow 3 hours long? Let's see, who else is here? Reese Witherspoon. She went right down to the wire over whether to wear Dior or REI. Over the course of this evening, you're going to see a lot of people clap when... Go away!
Kyone, are you hosting the Oscars again?
I'm perched on that fine line between a dream and a delusion. Didn't you see Silver Linings Playbook?
Don't you want to come downstairs and join the rest of us at the Oscar party?
You mean just regular people? Why would I do that when I'm up here, you know, on stage and Natalie Portman and John Hamm are in the audience cracking up over how cute and funny I am? Hi, John. Call me.
They're figments of your imagination. We're real.
I know. That's what I hate about you. We'll work this out while the rest of you listen to the nose. And now he's still paranoid that his vote for Gloria Swanson wasn't counted. Colin McEnroe.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it was, I think, 1930, one of the first times I voted in the Academy Awards. All right, so we're going to talk about the Oscars, the Academy Awards today. We've got movie mavens, cinephiles here for you. And we also want to hear from you as we go along, 860-275-7266. Meanwhile, from the Culture Dogs, a WWUH radio show about exactly this sort of thing. Are you doing a live show for...
Yeah, I was normally I have a party in my domicile, but this year I'm going to go on the air.
All right, that's Sam Hatch along with Kevin O'Toole. They are the Culture Dogs on WWUH. So will that be at 8 p.m. on Sunday night?
It will, yeah. All right. So we'll be talking about the red carpet, you know, best dress, worst dress, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, you guys will be worst dressed.
Absolutely. We always win that every year.
Also with us, she now runs her own business. It's called Omusono. I actually bought a lot of Christmas presents from Omusono this year. And so you can go to omusono.com. Am I saying it right, Omusono?
You're good.
I'm nailing it, right?
Yeah,
I'm killing it, all right? Vivian Nabetta is here with us. We never do the Oscar show without Vivian Nabetta. And joining us also, James Haley from Trinity Cine Studio. Of course, we've got to have James for this. So I'm just going to start. I'm going to throw out an impression that I have. But I can't tell whether it's an accurate impression, whether it's tied to my mood, the snow. But I just remember last year, James, you know, as I beheld the Academy Award nominations and sort of was looking at these performances in the movies, and it really was, you know, 12 Years a Slave and American Hustle and Philomena and Her and Dallas Buyers Club and I'm leaving something. Oh, Nebraska, a movie I really sort of really kind of grew on me. I thought, this has been a really great year in movies. I mean, this is like even given that the Academy Awards has its own highly fetishized idea of what the best movies are, even factoring for that, these are some really good movies. And even though there's some movies that I like quite a bit in this field, I don't feel the same way here in 2014, but I can't tell whether it's – or 2015, really. But I can't tell whether it's just the piles of snow or the piles of crap on the movie screen. So which one is it?
It's a general enemy induced by the snow. But I think I sort of have that feeling too. I mean, I find the films that this year, they're interesting, definitely. And I mean, I really enjoyed Birdman, for example. But I also have sort of things about it that trouble me. It's not that significant a movie, really. It's kind of like a navel-gazing movie in a way, but a really good one. But still navel-gazing. And it seems like large issues of distance. It's almost like, okay, been there, done that. Mm-hmm. And so this year isn't going to be like that. And so we'll look at other things. And I think that these things do go in cycles. I can tell you from programming movies, certainly, that some years you just have sort of this whole package of films waiting to be shown, you know, that you think are really significant, really important films. And I'd say more sort of like it's gone away from the real world to kind of the entertainment conceit of Hollywood kind of thing in a way. That's where it seems to have gone this year. And to me, it's interesting as an insider, really, as a film programmer, but maybe not so much real world.
Okay, so Vivian, you're less of an insider, but you do make these long enforced marches and try to see all of these movies. So how did it leave you feeling at the end?
Well, I kind of felt like, for me, it was the year of movies I really wanted to like. Mm-hmm. You know, you go in and you're like, everyone said this is great and wonderful, and you're like, it was nice. And like, I sound like my mom. That's what it was nice. You know, I enjoyed it. And you really wanted to like them a lot more than what you did. Especially since considering the topics and some of the things that were discussed, you should have left the movie theater in tears or have called your therapist. A lot of movies, I kind of felt, I enjoyed it. I feel like a smarter, better person, but
Name a movie in particular that kind of left you feeling that way.
Oh, God, I don't want to say it because I feel like a terrible person saying it.
You're going to say Selma.
No, I'm going to say The Theory of Everything. Please don't kill me, public radio audience. Please don't kill me.
A lot of people feel that way.
And I thought Eddie Redmayne, obviously. I'm just going to say it now. I think he's going to win. But I just felt like it was a good movie, I guess, and I enjoyed learning about Stephen Hawking, but I didn't feel like I wasn't as emotionally connected as I felt like I should be for that kind of a movie.
What about you, Sam? Are you a happy culture dog this year?
I think I actually connected a little more with the films this year than I did the previous year, though they all do fall under the same umbrella for me, is that there's not that one clear contender. There's not that killer app, that film that really just jumped above and beyond all the others. And I think there's this type of film that the Academy is looking for. And if they don't have a clear winner that fits that, then they have a bunch of other, like you mentioned, very good films, but not particularly the most amazing things you've seen in the year. And they're definitely not going to give something like Guardians of the Galaxy that did connect with audiences incredibly in this huge kind of zeitgeist way. They're not going to give that an award. So in this case, they're just going to give the award to a handful of films that did the job but didn't particularly hit the mark, maybe.
If you were an Academy voter, would you have voted for Guardians of the Galaxy had you had that opportunity?
For Best Picture? I don't know. I think Interstellar maybe over Guardians of the Galaxy.
I would have voted for Interstellar myself.
Yes. You would have for Best Picture?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I would. Yeah. I think that Interstellar is a film that took on huge issues, and it also took on what to me is the nexus of cinema, which is good writing and a story and also a sense of the emotion that can convey about loss, about disconnect. There were so many themes, so many large themes in that movie that Christopher Nolan sort of, I always felt that about the Batman Dark Knight trilogy, that he took on the incredible dysfunction of the Batman character as for real. Yeah. All of a sudden, it wasn't a comic character. It was for real. And Inception was disturbing in a way that you had to sort of pay attention to it, and it made you really think about the story and want to know, did this all really connect? Did
it
work?
I love that movie.
Yes, I loved
love
Inception. And I found Interstellar to be a film that was intellectually and emotionally at a nexus that should be, to me, was the transport of cinema that took me to that place. So certainly I would have voted for that.
As James knows, I hated Interstellar with the power of 1,000 black holes. And I thought in particular it failed to make emotional sense.
That's how I felt about Tree of Life.
Well, yes. Well, I understand that. But here's the thing also. I think every year we kind of go through this paroxysm a little bit every year where there are these movies that in which we have invested a lot of belief and faith in them as artistry. And we sort of understand they're not going to win Academy Awards, right? I mean, I really did feel Tree of Life was by far the best movie that year. But I also understood that was – I mean, it was craziness. It was craziness even that it was a nominated film, that it was being thought about that way. I understood that. And so I feel like for some of us this year, and I a little bit for James and definitely for me, that the Grand Budapest Hotel is – surprisingly, I mean, a movie which I really do think is the best movie I saw all year. I've seen it three times. I'm just getting warmed up. And the idea that it – I don't know. It probably is sort of like around fourth or fifth place right now. Yeah. You know, it's not the top two, and it's probably not even the top three. But, I mean, it's not this – it's not Tree of Life, which was like the least likely film to win in its year. To me, that's – I find that a little surprising and pleasantly surprising.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I certainly would say Grand Budapest Hotel would be a great winner, really, for lots of reasons. But one of the things is a sort of zeitgeist of the world at the time of now, in that Stefan Zweig, who wrote the original story that film is from, that Wes Anderson adapted, it's really he was living in Austria at a time when he saw himself living as a relatively sort of stable, happy life and failed to see the dangers of Nazism coming. And then he wrote very eloquently about how the destruction that was coming and how he – and, of course, he escaped and went elsewhere and came to the United States. But he wrote a story really that was about the very thing that many Hollywood movies are about, which is reassurance. Most movies – a lot of movies that become mainstream are about reassurance and at the end of the time when you've finished watching the movie. But Grand Budapest Hotel is not. It's about an observance of a sort of – don't be too reassured, really. And so I'd say absolutely, you know, that is one of my favorite movies. I mean, I like Wes Anderson, but I think that's a remarkable film.
Vivian, so we know a little bit about what Sam's struggle would have been between Guardians of the Galaxy and Interstellar, with Interstellar winning out. James, probably also Interstellar, with some props to Grand Budapest Hotel. What about you? What was the movie you loved this year? I mean, we know that there are a lot of movies where you went, that was nice. Was there a movie that really just sort of turbocharged you?
No. Sorry.
What
no.
if you had to? What if no. you were an Academy voter and you had to vote for one of these?
You know what? I think, let's be honest. We know they don't watch all the movies anyway. They're all in the industry. They don't watch. They go, oh, I'd probably go, hey, Jim Tapplin, who are you voting for? And then I would just pick what he would pick.
No,
which is
wouldn't.
What happens.
You would not. So there wasn't there really even in this field of eight or nine or whatever it
no.
is, there isn't really one.
No, and I feel really bad about it because, again, considering a lot of the subject matter, a lot of the great performances, I would have liked to have been more passionate about it. I do have to admit I haven't seen Wild yet, which maybe if I'd seen it before the show.
It's not nominated for Best Picture anyway.
You know, Reese Witherspoon, you know, I kind of feel like it's her moment, you know, so, but... you know, no, I feel bad. I'm the Grinch that stole the Oscars today.
Well, you know, since you bring up Wild, there's something that I did want to talk about, and it wasn't in any of the emails that I sent to you.
Because oh, no,
I
a wild card.
A wild card.
But I'm ching.
Because I didn't really start thinking about it until this morning. And what I was thinking about is a trend that I think started in the 1990s and then really started to become kind of a problem, if it is a problem, subsequently in this century. And it is that I went back and looked at the kinds of performances that were nominated, let's say in the 1950s and early 1960s. And we know from watching Mad Men that women were not empowered during that time. That, you know, so you would think that their performances would be kind of marginalized. And so, but I looked, for example, at, I mean, I cherry picked a little bit here. So in 1958, Susan Hayward won for I Want to Live. She was up against Shirley MacLaine for Some Came Running, Rosalind Russell for Auntie Mame, Elizabeth Taylor for Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. There was also Deborah Kerr's performance in Severed Tables. One of the rules here is there's always a Deborah Kerr performance that I don't remember. But I mean, those are all movies that a lot of people saw. You know, those were movies that were part of the mainstream cultural dialogue. And just to continue on the same theme, so in 1960, 2 years later, Liz Taylor's up again, this time for Butterfield 8. I think she won. Greer Garson, Sunrise at Campobello. Deborah Kerr again for The Sundowners. Shirley MacLaine again for The Apartment. Melina Mercouri for Never on Sunday. Most of those movies also were mainstream movies. Those were performances that a lot of people saw. You didn't have to have some boutique, highly fetishistic taste to find those movies. You know, and then you sort of look in recent years. You look this year. It's Marianne Cotillard for 2 Days, 1 Night. Felicity Jones, Theory of Everything. Julianne Moore for Still Alice. Everybody knows she's going to win. Rosamund Pike for Gone Girl. Reese Witherspoon for Wild. I would say of that group, Gone Girl is the only movie that falls into that category. Right.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
And that's my favorite performance out of that bunch, too. I mean, Rosamund Pike, I've always been a fan of hers going back for, you know, until her Bond film in 2002. But I don't know. That film captivated me. I actually feel bad that it was left out. I'm a big David Fincher fan, and I was disappointed that you didn't get at least a nod for director. But no, that's the one that I'm on, you know, firing on all thrusters for, so hopefully.
I look back a few years to 2011. Meryl Streep won for The Iron Lady as Margaret Thatcher. Glenn Close was up for Albert Nobbs.
Yeah.
Viola Davis was up for The Help. Rooney Mara, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Michelle Williams, My Weekend with Marilyn. You know, again, these, for the most part, you know, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and The Help, those were mainstream movies. But, you know, a lot of movies that people kind of don't see, or you'd have to seek them out either because you want to see women in an important leading role, or you're just, you know, somebody like us who sees a lot of movies. And I don't know, James, what's going on there?
Well, I think there's a lot of things going on there. One is the natural sort of, like, natural in quotes, ironic quotes of Hollywood, you know, in terms of roles and what is seen to be an important role and what sort of gets given to women or to a black person. You know, it's like there's a sort of there's a kind of backward orthodoxy to Hollywood that still exists as strong as ever. Witness the nominations this year. And I think that's part of it. But there's also another thing that I think that films are somewhat marginalized in many cases, and people don't get to see them. If you look at Oscar nominees from the 60s, say, you're looking at a time when people did gather in large crowds and go to movies and see these things together. And now you're to fast forward to now, people are seeing films in different ways. They're not necessarily seeing them in theaters, for example. They're not necessarily wanting to see them right away. They see them later. And one of the classic examples, you're talking about how the Academy voters don't see all the films. Well, I think a worse thing in a way is that's the worst, is not seeing it at all. But then the next worst thing is seeing it on the DVD or the Blu-ray that they send to them and seeing it on a screen by themselves, maybe eating a pizza, you know.
Fast-forwarding.
Yeah, watching it at double speed.
Yep.
And
which I would really advise you do with Interstellar. But anyway.
I'll get back to you later on that one, Colin.
But continue.
But it's something that I think is a shame because if you don't see some of the nominees this year, if you don't see them on a large screen in the dark with a group of other people, it's a different experience from seeing it on a small screen in your home or on a cell phone, for heaven's sake. However all these alternate media are, it has the effect of sort of diluting the experience. It's not shared at the same time. And so I don't think that's one of the reasons why the Oscars don't have the same significance they had. I think that we're at a different place. And so it may be that, for instance, Wild, which I think is a great film, and it's very interesting what, you know, Reese Witherspoon has done with this and her, what she said about it. I think that's a film that really a lot of people would go to see. And it's now just sort of getting noticed. But the fact is that not many people have seen it yet. They've heard about it. And that's sort of like a theme for the period.
Yeah, but all I hear from my friends are, I've never heard of any of these films whenever the Oscar nominees come out.
Yeah.
Well, especially for the women. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Isaac, could you argue also, too, to a certain degree that communal experience, while it's great, people have more options, and because people have more options in media, movies that wouldn't have gotten seen are now able to be seen a little bit more, or because or that people who, you know, don't go to the movies for whatever reason it is, they do have an option to at least be part of that experience in a different way. Yeah. So maybe playing devil's advocate a little bit that
but the films
they're
watching
a downside and there's an upside to that.
The films they're watching that they wouldn't normally see are all straight to video Netflix films now. That's all of the kind of bulk of films that I know people are watching.
Yeah,
now,
that's, yeah, that's
are things
point.
That you're just yeah, yeah that would just be sitting on a store shelf in the background of the video store 10
that's
years
right.
ago.
I miss doing that, though.
That
don't you miss it? You would go and
through,
you'd find like a sequel of a movie that you're like, they made a second one?
I think that's one of the sort of paradoxes here. That, I mean, for instance, digital cinema has made it less expensive for small filmmakers, meaning filmmakers without a big financial backing, to make interesting films. And it's sort of turned filmmaking into something very different. And so it means, yes, they have access. But, of course, with the fragmentation of the market, how many people actually see it?
Yeah.
And especially also that they don't see it at the same time. And so it can be very difficult to get real notice, you know, or to get a lot of people to see it. Your friends might see it. You might get an article. You might get something online that tells people to see it. But it's not the same as that large coverage.
There's no groundswell. Yeah.
And it's very hard to achieve that. And I find that a sort of a paradox with the, you know, the sort of leveling effect of opening the industry by having a less expensive way to get in, and it's brought in these people, but it hasn't brought in the way to get those films seen.
And I do think that the phenomenon that you're describing sort of means that, and I don't know how this sorts itself out, what invisible hand does this. So you have Julianne Moore in Still Alice, which is this tiny little movie. It's about early onset Alzheimer's disease, therefore has a pretty self-selecting, highly specific audience. I mean, it just isn't intended to be a blockbuster. There isn't anybody involved in the process. I'm sure a lot of the actors on it worked for scale and all that kind of stuff. Back to what you were saying, you know, Vivian, so we have a process now that allows a movie like that to be discovered and cherished enough so that she's a shoo-in for the Oscar for this movie, really, that not very many people are going to go see, which, you know, in some ways, I think you're right. I think that's great in a way. But it also, it makes me think, you know, back to that time when, you know, Shirley MacLaine was really great in The Apartment and Some Game Running, and, like, everybody saw those movies. Too. It just seems weird now that and it's particularly true for these women's performances, you know, that the people who see them, it's just a much narrower subset. And it's like the studios don't even feel like they have to build the movie, build it up, make it that big.
It's almost a business card for a Best Actress nomination. There's been films like Vin Diesel notoriously made a film and screened it at Sundance that was really never meant to be seen as a film. It was just a business card to get him more acting jobs. So there's those films.
What movie was this?
I forgot the name
Triple
of it.
X,
it
was before, part it was like two.
The one that created the artistic cachet around
it's basically what got him Saving Private Ryan, whatever landed him that gig. He had a previous film that it was just all about him, starring him, directed by him.
I do remember him from Boiler Room. Is he in Boiler Room?
I love that film. Yeah.
And he's really good in Boiler Room, too. Wish he would do more movies like that, because he can do them. All right, we're wandering far afield, but that's a good sign, not a bad sign. Why don't we take a quick break here? We'd love to hear from you, too. 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. And we're back. We're talking about the Oscars. We'd love to have you chime in if you have gripes or things that made you very happy. Give us a call, 860-275-7266, or some aperçu that doesn't fall into either one of those categories. 860-275-7266. You may tweet us at WNPRColin. Our vast research department was able to determine that the movie, the Vin Diesel artistic cachet movie that Sam Hatch was talking about, Sam being one of 186 people who actually saw this movie, it's called Multifacial. Multifacial. So seek that out for wherever. I don't know. I bet
streaming, maybe.
Going to be on Netflix.
There you go.
Yeah, maybe it's going to be on YouTube.
That big bin in the Walmart. Yes.
At the bottom of the bin.
Yeah, right.
So, Sam, I want to talk about something that you brought up because I think it's really interesting, which is, Stephen Hawking may have a theory of everything. And if so, I assume it includes the kind of sort of wave effect of approval and disapproval that precedes the Oscars. And I'll give an example that you didn't bring up in your email, which is like today I'm probably finally going to go see Foxcatcher. Mm-hmm. But what I've really done is wait through a very complicated process in which Foxcatcher was one of those movies that was anointed very early on as, you know, real Oscar bait, and, you know, Steve Carell and Channing Tatum and Mark Ruffalo and Bennett Miller's the director, and boy, this is going to be just racking up nominations and stuff. And since I didn't see it right then because I wasn't playing in Hartford yet, then I sort of watched the wave completely change, and all these people kind of came forward and said, you know, this is kind of a meretricious piece of junk, actually. you know. But not enough people said that to deprive Bennett Miller of one of the coveted Best Director nominations, so that the director of Selma, for example, who a lot of people think should be in there, is not. But there's this thing, right, that you were trying to describe it too. I'm sure you can do a better job than I did.
Yeah, I kind of equate it with cultural speed up, that the situation where whereas even 10 years ago, you could – yeah, capably predict the film that was going to be, you know, the big front runner late in the year. And that now the public opinion keeps changing so drastically. And magazines like Entertainment Weekly are part of it, where they usually anoint, as you mentioned, something early on, maybe even as early as June, as the Oscar contender, the film to watch out for. And I remember it happening to The Lovely Bones. I remember it happening to The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. And those films came out and were dropped like a hot potato. And this year, Gone Girl, well, you know, being an early one, there was a cover story on EW. That's going to be David Fincher's Oscar grab. And then it amounts to nothing. And then another wave of films kind of settle in. Mm-hmm. And then yet another wave of films. I was mentioning, I just heard David Edelstein talking about how Birdman is now kind of taking the lead ahead of Boyhood as the kind of favorite. And I don't know, what it'll be tomorrow.
It's interesting about Gone Girl, you know, that there's a feeling in the industry that Gone Girl peaked too early, that they did the campaign. I mean, if you're seeing campaigns in the newspapers, or you're seeing something in magazines or online about this is the hot film, I mean, that didn't just happen. That's a publicist has gotten it out. And the big game in Hollywood, of course, is when you do it. And in the case of Gone Girl, a lot of people think that that happened too soon. And, of course, there's talk now about Boyhood being...
That was an early release,
An early release. And so people are sort of, you know, like, oh, they're looking for something new. Yep. It's the constant looking for a sort of new sensation that might shake up the field. And you've got all of these competing publicists who want to convey different ideas and somehow keep a film alive in the market, too. I mean, there are lots of films that come into the market with a lot of buzz, and then they don't do any business. Mm-hmm. And then the conundrum, of course, is how do you handle that if you're a publicist? Do you can you keep it in theaters long enough? Can you
do the re-release or
do a re-release, take it out and bring it back? Yeah. You know, you notice a lot of films open in December in Los Angeles and New York to get the qualification, but then they save them until the Christmas Day or the first week in January so that they then get the buzz then. But it's really always skating on the edge because you don't know what's going to really take off. And I think it's interesting that Grand Budapest Hotel is still part of the language, as it were, even though it's so far back.
Right.
That's a film that's really succeeded without that kind of push.
Mm-hmm. Well, can I add and then ask a question?
Yes.
When you had said about the timing of when they go for the Oscars, I read something that was talking about how Marianne Cotillard, they should have pushed it. They pushed it way too late, and had they waited, she would have had a better chance of winning. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that maybe people are more aware of it now, but people don't understand what a business or what an Oscar
That's
campaign
right.
is. So people think, oh, you just go to a movie and it's really good and people just magically find you and you get nominated.
And it is pretty clear with Selma, for example, that, you know, whatever else happened that was wrong, the mechanics of that was handled wrong because so many of these people do watch it on the Blu-ray that they get, and they didn't get their Blu-rays in time for nominations. And I mean, just the stark mechanics that you're talking about. I want to ask you something, which is I noticed that you kind of gulped or made another one of your mother's noises.
My mom's not listening, I hope, right now.
When Sam said something, said that he liked Rosamund Pike in Gone Girl, because I think it speaks to, well, tell us why you gulped about that.
Well, okay. So I will admit that I will say that I'm waving my judgment stick a little bit early, but only because it's such a Hollywood movie in the sense of the way the dragon tattoo. I mean, if there's a traditional Hollywood movie that's based off a book, because everything's based off of something these days, it's that movie. So I think for me, knowing what he does, I'm just surprised that such a movie that's part of the machine, he's like, oh, no, it was really great. I loved her. And I guess it's a testament to her performance and her acting as opposed to what she's being part of. And David Fincher is a good director, so
yeah,
I agree with you.
He's in the machine, but I don't see him as being part of it. He likes to kind of poke the machine with sticks.
Right.
Yeah. And I think
one of the problems for a lot of his movies, and it's definitely a problem, at least I think it's a problem for Gone Girl, you know, the Academy will forgive you for a lot of things, you know? And even though it is this incredibly hidebound, straight jacket bracketed institution that's never particularly satisfying in the way that they process the kind of material that we're talking about. They'll forgive you for a lot of things. But I think misanthropy is one. I mean, I'm sure I can be proven wrong with some. But, you know, there's a misanthropy at the heart of Gone Girl. I mean, David Fincher doesn't like people very much.
No.
He has a very low opinion of the human race. And at the end of that movie, that's the essential message. Yep. There's absolutely nobody here that you should invest any faith in whatsoever. And I just don't know that the Academy – I mean, they'll look at a lot of – I mean, Birdman's a very crazy and I thought very laudable movie, and it's kind of misanthropic too, but there is this sort of magical realism element of hope in it, which I think Fincher doesn't deliver. You know?
Well, I think it's kind of interesting you mentioned Birdman, because Iñárritu is a director, Alejandro Iñárritu, the director, is a person who, I mean, he really at his heart, he's an art filmmaker. You know, he makes films that not that many people see that are really great. And David Fincher is actually that. But I sort of think that both David Fincher and Iñárritu have maybe taken a look at what's happened with Christopher Nolan, and that Christopher Nolan basically got Warner Brothers to fork over the money for his pet project, which was Inception.
Such a weird film. How did he?
Exactly. He wanted to make this weird, complicated film that every Hollywood agent said, this is crazy because nobody will ever figure out that plot, and they'll be so angry at you they won't. You know, this film will fail. Well, it was a huge success, of course, and so he makes lots of money. And so he can then go out and tell Paramount, oh, by the way, we need 66 IMAX film prints to show Interstellar. And I think that there's an attraction to that, that David Fincher, with Gone Girl, is making a mainstream film, which is sort of contains that brand of misogyny in it, that is also aiming right at the heart of that sort of it's kind of like reassuring thriller kind of thing. It's getting back to this reassurance thing. It's more of a sort of sure thing to agents as well.
Oh, wait, you mean it's not a romantic comedy?
No.
No.
Well, I think
well, you could read it that
in
way.
In a way.
I think it sort of is, actually.
In a way, yeah.
I actually do feel there is a moment in the movie. First of all, the audience that I was in laughed a bit. I mean, this goes back to James's point about seeing it with audiences. Always so interesting. When I saw No Country for Old Men, I was the only person laughing a lot all the way through this movie.
Really?
You know, I felt like I was in a Charles Adams cartoon or something. But anyway.
Half the audience is horrified, and the other half wants to laugh but doesn't.
And then, certainly in Gone Girl, the moment where, I mean, you know, without trying to do any spoilers here, there's sort of been a revelation of how completely evil and rotten to the core everybody kind of is. And there's Ben Affleck walks into the kitchen in this beautiful, you know, just model house. And Rosamund Pike is standing there just immaculately dressed. And there's this beautifully laid out sort of center island in the kitchen. And she goes, crepes, you know, and she's got all the ingredients and the fruit and stuff. And I laughed really hard. You know, it was kind of like, oh, here's the worm in the American apple, you know.
It's right okay there. To spoil it for people at this point.
Yeah.
I think there's an expiration date on spoilers.
You're going to speed up. It just keeps getting closer and closer. I think there's a two-week expiration date. And then you
I give it like a month.
I thought Gone Girl was essentially Rosemary's Baby. I mean, it was sort of about a relatively innocent person, or maybe a couple of relatively innocent people in the thrall of this completely evil family.
And actually, Rosemary's Baby is a perfect example of a movie that you couldn't have a spoiler. I mean, it's just by nature. You know what it is, and you knew the characters. I mean,
who's the father?
You know, one of the things we should quickly talk about, I mean, every year there are just these real controversies. And this year you didn't really have to go hunting very far to find the first controversy. I mean, there just aren't any actors of color nominated. And Selma in particular seems to have taken quite a hit, maybe because of the mechanics, maybe because of some other reason, maybe because the Academy does have a race problem, maybe who knows what. But, I mean, I'm fascinated by these other kind of almost manufactured – I think they're a manufactured controversy. So one of the ones that came up was that there might be something anti-Latino about Boyhood because of this scene in which Patricia Arquette kind of, you know, gets this yard guy and says, boy, you should go back to college.
You're smart, yeah.
Yeah, you're smart, you know. And then he gets this – he comes up to her in a restaurant later and he's the assistant manager or whatever he is at that point.
Yeah, he is a manager.
He's a manager.
Yeah.
He owes it all to her. you know, their foods on him. And for some reason that bothered people. I couldn't really understand how, but then it was occasioned by another wave of people saying, well, somebody should talk about Ian, or I can't say his name. Say his name for me again. The Birdman guy.
Michael Keaton?
No, the director.
The director. Alejandro Iñárritu.
Yeah, Iñárritu. And Cuarón, that they don't make Latino movies anymore because of exactly what James was talking about. You know, they figured out there's all this money.
Their exit strategy.
That's who you really should be screaming at, not at Richard Linklater for Boyhood. And I thought, wow, it's like this is like an industry now on the web, right? They're just like they're just looking for stuff.
Yeah.
To bash people with.
I think that's something you always have to retain in perspective, and how really one person's comment and somebody seeing something. People are combing, looking for things really to make a conversation about sometimes, and these sites that I think is a basic problem with the internet being advertising driven, that you're looking for clicks.
And there's too many of them out there.
Right, exactly. And so you generate the clicks however you might. But there's a lot of discussion about films or about culture generally that really have substance and they're really interesting, but you also have to separate out things that are red herrings that don't really mean anything necessarily. I mean, the argument about Iñárritu making a film about, you know, basically a has-been white actor, you know, it's like a sort of white environment that is of the Broadway scene and stuff like that. But he's a great filmmaker who has made other kinds of films as well, but he's decided to do sort of mainstream things. Is that being racist, you know? Or then racism itself has a lot of complexities about, you know, knowing what people's intent is and why they're doing things. And when you are creating something, the Hollywood environment, which views race as a kind of commodity that is related to how much money will be made, it's something that is part of that system that does have racist components. That's real, and that's different from the Latino character in Boyhood. I think is actually a very interesting character, and it's part of a very genuine film. And somebody made the point that this guy played that role very, very well, and actually brought out some subtleties about it that, you know, actually made you think.
Especially given the fact that, you know, more than half of the U.S. Congress right now, their only reaction would be to get that guy deported. Vivian, what were you going to say?
I just think that it's also speaking to a larger issue, because I think that because there's so few people who don't look a certain way, define that as you will, public radio audience, that when you have one or two or three, unfortunately, they become everything for everybody. Yeah. And so it's unfortunate that it's not an environment where you can just be a filmmaker and make a film, or just getting I can't remember what I was listening to. I was listening to the Nerdist podcast. I never listened to that, by the way. But
Chris Hardwick.
Yeah, exactly. And so whoever he was talking to was saying it's just amazing that films even get made, and that you can start a project in 5 years and 10 years, you're still trying to get it done. But I think that these conversations about, you know, is this particular film being shafted because of this or is it because of that, that where the real issue is that if we're going to be making films and supporting films, we need to look at what that means and who is invited to the table. I think they're different ways of saying the same thing. And I think if there's a broader base, then there's a larger discussion about that.
Absolutely. And it's about jobs in the industry. Exactly. It's about actually having the technicians and everybody on the film set. Plus, it means characters that are not race identified and that they're not projecting culture by their presence.
I think it also means that you don't have just one Ava DuVernay, that everybody has an opportunity to be her. You don't have, you know, your one person that is allowed to ascend to the throne, and then we got to wait till that person dies or fall off the, you know, fall off the wagon. You don't have that one female director. You don't have that one. It's about making that opportunity available to everybody.
I think Wesley Morris was the one who said this week that, you know, he was happy to see Lupita Nyong'o win a Best Supporting Actress award last year, but he wants to see Lupita Nyong'o win a Best Supporting Actor award or Best Actor award as a CEO or something.
Right.
You know?
I mean,
and that's the race specific thing that you're talking about. Before we run out of time, Sam, I turn to you especially. One thing I brought up in my emails is I sometimes wish there were other categories.
Yeah.
You know, there are certain things that you wind up liking over the course of a year that you just know don't fit into any kind of template or narrative that the Academy would consider. I mean, I gave gave as my example the performance of Jake Gyllenhaal in Nightcrawler, where you just know he's not going to win Best Actor.
But it's notable. Yeah.
Yeah. You sort of wish there was some way of honoring, like, yeah. I'm sure you have, like, a whole list of those kinds of things or those kinds of performances or movies.
Oh, and on Culture Dogs, we have our own little sub-Oscars called the Woofies, and one of the, you know, the categories, because we get to make up our own categories, is, you know, Best Comedy or Wrestling Film, or, you know, the Ben Affleck film that stunk the least every year. I'd like to see a Charles Bronson kind of award for all the Liam Neeson films that come out that are identical every year.
Then you could throw in. There's a new one now.
You saw
the commercial?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. There's
a new one.
And then you could throw
God,
in maybe Denzel Washington from The Equalizer and maybe 3 Days to Kill with Costner in that. But they give that Charles Bronson award. But yeah, that'd be great. It'll mix it up a little bit. Get some. I'd like to see. I don't know. I'd like to see just some awards for films that aren't even more close to what the Golden Globes has, at least something that's a little bit more comedy-based, mm-hmm. as opposed to just animated and live action. I'd love to see a way that a film like Snowpiercer could get nominated for something.
And James, I think another thing that's endangered, or that they're going to have to deal with at some point, I mean, you know, as a society – Our ideal confluence and the confluence we've been trying to make over the last few decades is to judge the work of everybody kind of on the same platform. So, you know, why wouldn't you compare Meryl Streep to Daniel Day-Lewis? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's sort of interesting that the Oscars is they're you know, angling to be the last place in the world where the work of men and the work of women is considered separately. And even now, as we're having also these big debates about transgender pronouns and people who aren't that comfortable being either he or she, somebody's going to be nominated who's like that, you know?
Exactly.
And you just wonder how much longer can sex segregation hold out or gender segregation hold out in the Oscars?
Well, I think that that's part of the orthodoxy of the Academy and the industry itself, which is not inclined to take risks. And I think it goes back, for instance, going back to Jake Gyllenhaal's performance in Nightcrawler, which to me was the very essence of cinema. And I can see it being something that plays for weeks and weeks in certain areas where people sort of find this film. It has a sense of the ethos. It's very critical of certain established sort of business procedures in Los Angeles and elsewhere. It has a character who, I mean, an actor who's willing to completely transform himself into this character. And it's something that sort of breaks out of the norm, and there is no sort of place for that. And the orthodoxy of race and gender and exactly sort of bean counting, really, is that's the problem, I think, with the system as it exists. And it's not just in Hollywood. I think it's the way that films are shown, the way that films are distributed. I think you have large operations, really, which are involved in selling food that actually happen to show movies as a, you know, just by chance. And maybe that'll bring in some people who buy the food. And so you have a kind of distorted marketplace that is guarded by people who have a very orthodox point of view, who do see division between race and between gender. I mean, they will have no idea to deal with transgender issues. They will have no idea to. It'll take years for that to actually come to the surface. It'll take somebody eloquent to break out of that who has a voice. And so it's something that you've got to fight against, and it's very laggard to the general culture, I think.
Speaking of the categories, I think you should do the food distribution. That should be awarded, most effective usage of Skittles, that kind of thing. And, yeah.
Maximum number of Skittles per performance.
Exactly.
Vivian, what are you going to say? You'll get the last word.
Well, let's be honest, though. If we didn't segregate by category, there would be no women nominated. I'm just going to say it that way because, you know what? I'm the Oscar Grinch today.
All right. You are going to be Oscar.
I am.
We're going to do some endorsements here at the end, so we'll take a little break, so we'll have time for that. We'll be back. I'll be like Steve McQueen. I'll play your favorite parts. I'll see you at the Oscars.
And the Oscar for best phone answering on a radio show goes to Sissy Spacek. Betsy Kaplan didn't get it? That is a total shock. And here comes Kanye. Back, Kanye. This is neither the time nor the place Today's show was produced by Colin and me, Kyone Wolf. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. The part of Bill Curry was played by Walter Brennan. For show pages, articles, and videos of the Faith Middleton Show staff doing the You Was My Brother, Charlie speech from On the Waterfront, visit our website, WNPR.org. On Monday's show, The Scramble breaks down the news of the weekend. And now, back to Colin.
You know, one of the, Betsy Kaplan, by the way, who is answering the phones today, and there hasn't been one call, but one of the disturbing things about autofill is that when you're trying to look up something about Charlie, You Was My Brother, you keep getting, Google keeps trying to get you to Charlie Bit My Finger, which is an indication that our civilization is in decline. All right, so time for endorsements. James, what have you got?
Two things. First of all, there's a new edition of Stefan Zweig's story, The World of Yesterday, from 1942, which is the basis of the film, the Wes Anderson film. And it's really extraordinary. It's worth reading. It's about the time in Europe before, just as the Nazis were rising. But it's something that is extraordinarily well written about being complacent and thinking that everything is fine and not taking action when perhaps you should and being aware of what's around you. And I think that's a really, a remarkable theme that's relevant to us now. And the other thing is a wild and crazy comedy at Cine Studios starting on Sunday and actually running through Thursday called The Passionate Thief with the great Anna Magnani. And if you ever saw A Big Deal on Madonna Street from roughly the same period, it's the same director, Mario Monicelli, and it's an incredible performance, an incredible snapshot of a time in the 60s of Italian comedy at its height. An absolutely amazing restoration that is really well worth seeing.
And just see stuff at Trinity Cine Studio. And they've got Foxcatcher coming in very soon, too. Vivian, what have you got?
Well, I'm going to be self-promotional because that's how I roll. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to endorse myself. So as you know, omusono.com, omusono.com. You can get cute stuff. Colin can tell you.
Yeah. And then African-themed and African imports, basically.
And everything's handmade, so you're not supporting the man unless you want to.
All right.
But, so...
It's really great, by the way. I did buy a lot of Christmas presents there, and people loved everything they got. So
thank you.
It was good. Sam, what have you got?
I think I'll endorse a couple of documentaries quickly that did not get nominated for Best Documentary Feature. Jodorowsky's Dune is a fascinating making of a film that never got made in the 70s, an adaptation of Frank Herbert's Dune, which later David Lynch notoriously turned into something in the 80s. But yeah, a really fascinating film that had input from H.R. Giger and other luminaries. And yeah, I think you can find that streaming now. And also another documentary called As the Palaces Burn, which is this just fascinating film that evolves into another film. It's essentially a fan expose of fans of this one hard rock band. And when they go to Czechoslovakia, the band is detained and the lead singer is accused of murdering a fan 2 years prior by pushing him off the stage. And it becomes this amazing legal morass and really, really intense film. And finally, The Man in the High Castle, the Amazon pilot Philip K. Dick adaptation. Check that out if you can.
Really?
Yeah.
All right. Great endorsements. I will once again remind you that on Sunday night, if you're not listening to the Culture Dogs or seeing the movie that James is showing or at home ordering a new handbag from Omusono, you can go to the Oscar party. It's at the Spotlight Theaters. It supports AIDS Connecticut. It's a great cause. You can get online and read more about it. And it's really a fun party, too. And a lot of people from the news are going to be there. Also, including Vivian Abed, apparently. tonight, not that I'll be there, I don't think, but I just want to endorse, first of all, the incredible Irish music program that's done at the University of Hartford that our friend Steve Dietrich does, and Celtic Airs, I think it's called. Tonight, there's a band called Socks in the Frying Pan, which is sounds like a great name for a Dublin band, and I've been checking them out on YouTube. They really do look like they're a lot of fun. They do everything from Irish trad to Guy Clark tunes and stuff like that. However, it turns out not everybody in my life enjoys Irish music quite as much as I do. There's always this sort of stony silence when I say, hey, how about this? Nobody really says no. They just nobody really says yes.
Do they run
either.
Away?
They just shuffles quietly.
They slowly
from you.
Move into another direction.
And then very quickly, I know I keep pushing this, but it's going to be a lot more fun if more people do it. The Morning News, the website, The Morning News, is running a tournament of books on March 6th. We're going to do the news about the tournament of books. They do it as if it's the March Madness NCAA basketball tournament, but it's all recent literary fiction. So get on The Morning News, check that out, read some of those books because you'll have more fun when we do.
You think that you can be an actor? See Mr. Factor. He'd make a monkey look good. Within a half an hour, you'll look like Tyrone Power. Hooray for Hollywood.
Reese Witherspoon from Wild is up for an Oscar, and that really sticks in my craw. I do heroin once and get lost for 45 minutes in an Arby's, but does anybody make a movie about it? No. Scratch Arby's heroin joke.